This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
A very good morning to the entire universe from BFM's Morning Run. This morning, I'm Kusu Chong, joined by Wong Xiaoning and Philip C.
Great day in the US, all green. The Dow was up 0.1%. S&P 500 also in positive territory at 0.5%, as well as the Nasdaq 0.8%. Asia followed Q. Hang Seng was flat. Shanghai Composite was up 0.5%. Nikkei and ST was up 0.3%. And as expected, ZIG comes with ZAG, FBM, KLCI was down 0.1%.
Well, exactly. So to explain all the whys and the wherefores of the markets, we've got on the line with us now Jeffrey Helly, the senior market analyst at Owenda. Now, Jeffrey, talk to us about the US inflation report where they came in, the data, at a higher than expected 0.6%, yet markets seem to shrug off this higher than expected reading. What's your take on that?
Yeah, good morning, guys. I think it's because it came in less than last month's 0.8% rise. And I think that's why we didn't get any, tapering momentum, so to speak. Yes, the CPI rose by 0.6%, but I think the markets have been quite clearly signalling they're comfortable with inflation at this stage. We've seen US 10-year yields, for instance, hitting 3-4-month lows. And there's been definitely a lot of complacency around the inflation. I think what it's saying is the market is agreeing with the Federal Reserve for now, and that they feel that this inflation is transitory and not sticky wage price spiral inflation, and therefore it should drop out of all these CPIs next year. Either that or they're being horribly complacent. So I think we needed to see a print above 0.8% to have got the inflationistas out of bed and seen a sell-off in bonds and equities. So my guess is that this will be business as usual into the end of the week as we look forward to the Fed, I guess, next week.
Yeah, but Jeff, are you convinced, though, that the inflation is transitory in nature?
I'm erring towards the transitory side, but I'm keeping an open mind right now. And I think the honest answer here is that we just don't know. And I've been saying this for a little while now. There's been some mixed messages in the data points, not just in the US, but also from around the world. But if we look at the US, yes, CPI is high, but we've had two misses on the downside in a row in non-farm payrolls. But on the other hand, the small businesses surveys have record job openings and much higher wage expectations, yet the initial jobless claims fall is now slowing down quite noticeably. So these mixed messages have left the market in a limbo. And in a limbo, the default position is central banks are easing, pumping the economies full of money, buy everything, basically. We're seeing this process of asset price inflation, the same as we have since March 2020.
I mean, we talked about the impact on domestic markets in the US, but do you think there's a spillover effect in our region in this part of the world?
Look, we're definitely seeing inflation spillovers, and we're seeing those all over the world. But from my point of view, a lot of this has been caused by one-off events. Obviously, the pandemic has disrupted supply chains everywhere, and that's pushing up prices. We're not really seeing any evidence yet, for example, that Chinese exporters are raising prices dramatically for exported goods, even though their PPI numbers, their factory price input numbers, are hitting multi-decade highs. And that's sort of been a trend we've seen for the last 20 years, to be honest. We haven't seen exporters raising prices to end users. And I'm not quite sure if this is going to be enough of an event to change that outlook.
Well, when you mention China, obviously the US and its approach towards China is very much the order of the day. And based on the recent news flow on that front, how do you gauge the Biden administration's approach to China, especially with its wolf warrior diplomacy?
Yeah, I don't really see a lot changing from the previous administration, to be honest, apart from the wording. But I mean, Mr. Biden's administration does appear to be more open to do business with China. They had the commerce ministers had a very productive or an open call yesterday, and that lifted Asian stock markets. So we can see how closely tied Asia's equity market performance is to the path of US-China relations. I think this two largest kids in the playground not sharing the toys is going to be the new normal, and Asia needs to, the rest of Asia needs to find a path to manage between those two kids. To be honest, I do feel that relations will improve, but they're not going to go back to what they were. I think we've seen the peak in that, and I think both China and the US are looking at each other as competitors now, and the rest of us are going to be stuck in the middle.
And staying on the China theme, as you know, the PBOC hinted that it may loosen its grip over the yuan and allow it to trade more in alignment with the basket of currencies. What are the possible reasons for that shift in policy?
I think they are having an ongoing process of gradually internationalizing the yuan and gradually opening up their markets. I don't think this has changed at all. It's been subsumed in the noise of the last 5 years, and we probably don't have to tread back over that, the reasons for that, but it's an ongoing process. But also, I believe that keeping the total control of the capital account, it's probably not really feasible in the longer term. If China really wants to be a world economic power, if it wants to be a center of finance, if it wants to have the yuan as a reserve currency, it needs to allow more flexibility in its exchange rate, because by keeping a peg, whether it's sort of like a dirty peg or a fixed peg, even to a basket of currencies, to mostly the US dollar and G7 currencies, you may as well go and use those other currencies. You don't need to use the yuan if there's a peg there, if that makes sense to you. So I think this is part of the internationalization and process for China financial markets.
And Jeff, let's shift our attention to one asset class, which is, I think, becoming a little bit more mainstream. And that's on the back of the news that the Basel Committee on Banking Supervision, I mean, they are going to propose a 1,250% risk weight to be applied to any bank's exposure to Bitcoin and other cryptocurrencies. Does this really mean it is here to stay, Bitcoin?
I'm not saying that it's going away, but I think that the virtual currency space in general faces some very serious risks now on the regulatory front. Now, those regulations may be light or they may be heavy, but I'm looking at the volatility, and you're looking at ransoms being paid in bitcoins from cyber attacks. And this JB Meets one, they paid $11 million with the Bitcoin the other day. You know, they're facilitating cyber attacks on critical infrastructure around the world. I think that's basically got some very important people around the world looking at virtual currencies very closely, and some action will follow. So I continue to believe that there's material risks to the cryptocurrency space from regulation from major powers around the world. I believe that most banks are probably adopting that weighting anyway, at a minimum, for virtual currencies if they actually hold any. But I think that level has been set there probably to signal to the banking community around the world that while regulators will tolerate it for now, they're not keen on the banking sector having huge exposures to the crypto space.
All right, Jeffrey, thanks so much for your time. That was Jeffrey Haley, Senior Market Analyst at Oanda. Now, just on the point of the cryptocurrency paradigm, you know, it just seems as if there's a begrudging acceptance of Bitcoin, right? And they've got no choice because so many people around the world have taken to it like a duck to water. The problem is the regulators themselves, their very existence is being put at risk by the presence of cryptocurrencies, because the very centerpiece of cryptocurrencies is the deregulation of intermediaries like the central banks. So why would the central banks validate this upstart which might basically threaten its very existence?
I don't think they have a choice, John.
They don't have a choice. That's why it's begrudging.
Right? So, yeah, you're right. It's begrudging. But there are reasons, I think, central banks, aside from the fact that you say that it bypasses them, there are still risks. And one of which, of course, is that transactions between you and I when it comes to Bitcoin are completely opaque. And that's something central banks do not like at all. Even China, especially China, if you ask me.
And there was a story on Jeff was mentioning about ransomware being paid entirely by crypto.
Oh, yeah, 100%.
Correct? And what they do is that you pay the crypto, then they get into a mixing machine where all the crypto is mixed and redistributed. But what the Fed now is able to do with crypto is they'll be able to trace and identify the types of attacks that take place. So crypto is also a great way to address and attack also ransomware. So there are a bit of pros and cons also that come with also adopting something like crypto, because you can kind of build that traceability as well.
Yeah, and it's quite incongruous that the drop in Bitcoin and the cryptocurrency world has come at a time that ransomware has become so de rigueur among these plunderers. Mm.
But I'm not surprised Bitcoin, I mean, you all know I'm not a big fan of it because I don't know how to value it, right? But the frothiness of it could not be understood when Bitcoin was up 100% on the year to date, Ethereum was up 700%. What was the basis of that? And we've had many calls with commentators, and honestly, nobody could really put their finger on it. It's just a question of demand, supply, inflation questions. But other than that, how do you really value it?
The problem I have is that I think the issue with it is that we think too much of the currency part versus the crypto. So we treat it like an equity with the expectation it becomes a currency.
Yeah.
I think that's a very good point.
And that is the problem
here. It's the very good point, yeah. And a lot of people who are involved in cryptos are looking at people like us in the conventional world saying, they don't get it, and therefore we are the ones who get it.
But, you know, if you don't get it, if the mainstream don't get it, then you're always going to have this kind of volatility because the players that participate are too small.
Correct. Very quickly, because we talked about China, Didi Zuching, the ride-hailing firm, has revealed that they're going to go public. They've seen revenues, I think, double in the latest quarter, seeking valuation of as much as $100 billion, despite the fact that they made a loss in the previous corresponding.
That's a decacon for you.
That is a decacon, isn't it?
Yeah, but just another company that's losing money but still going for a listing at an extremely high valuation. Woohoo! Capital markets for you.
Tell me a ride-hailing business that's actually made money in 2020.
I think, we don't know because Grab doesn't disclose. Grab doesn't disclose, actually.
Uber doesn't make money, neither does Lyft.
And Grab, we don't know.
Yeah.
That means Grab is what? Grab is looking at $40 billion. Didi is looking at $100 billion. So Grab isn't doing too bad for a Southeast Asian startup.
Not bad at all.
Okay, up next, we'll take a look at some local headlines. Stay tuned, BFM 89.9.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, the business station.